her only question for Owen slipped out of her mouth. "You never came back to Cape Cod." When they'd parted, at the end of the summer, they had planned on staying together, or at least trying to, even though they were going to different colleges. Sarah had a Motorola flip phone back then, and Owen, without a phone of his own, was going to call her as soon as he had his dorm phone number. But he'd never called. Instead, a week after they'd started college, he'd sent her a 2-sentence email telling her he'd met someone at Duke, presumably during orientation. Orientation, Sarah had wept to her mother. He couldn't even wait for classes to start. And that he wanted to break up. "It's for the best," he'd written. "We should both be free." She'd cried. Then she'd emailed, begging him to call her, thinking that maybe, if he heard her voice, he'd remember how much he loved her and how much she loved him. When Owen hadn't called or written back, Sarah had been devastated. She didn't want her freedom or some boy from BU or MIT or Harvard. She wanted Owen. And Owen clearly had no longer wanted her. For the entire school year, she'd held out hope, ignoring the boys who did want to date her and waiting for summer to come. She thought that as soon as they saw each other, the Cape would work its magic again, and Owen would remember that he loved her. But that hadn't happened. She'd never seen Owen again, not on Cape Cod or anywhere else. A pugnacious-looking woman with a pug on a pink leather leash came toward them, bugling, "Excuse me," as she approached. Owen and Sarah stepped to the far edge of the sidewalk, where Owen shifted his weight from foot to foot. "I owe you an explanation, but it's a long story." "I'm not in a rush." He smoothed his tie again. "The short version is that Sass and Anders got divorced. Then Sass got married again, and her new husband hated Cape Cod. He said you never saw anyone who mattered there. He had a place in the Hamptons." "I'm sure your mom liked that." Owen's mother, Ballard Moreland Lassiter Ringquist, known for obscure reasons dating back to her childhood as Sass, had divorced Owen's father when Owen was 5 and had married Owen's stepfather when Owen was 7. Owen's biological father, meanwhile, had been on his 3rd marriage by the time Sarah met Owen. "How are your parents?" Owen asked Sarah, as the traffic surged by them, taxis honking, pedestrians blank-faced and exhausted as they made their way home at the end of the day. "How's your brother?" "Sam's good. He's out in California." No point in getting into Sam's situation now. How he'd gotten married and had then been widowed and was now a stepfather. "And my mother's well," she swallowed and wondered how long it would hurt to say out loud. "My dad died just over a year ago." "Oh, no, I'm sorry," he said. "I know how much you loved him." Sarah nodded, not trusting herself to speak. She was remembering how Eli had tended to her after her father's death, bringing her plates of toast and cups of tea, rubbing her back, keeping the boys occupied when Sarah had stayed in her bedroom and cried. Her father had loved Sam, of course, but he and Sarah had enjoyed a different bond. There was something special about a father and his little girl, especially if she was his only daughter. She'd seen it with Eli and Ruby. It had been one of the things that made her love her husband. Owen's gaze returned to her left hand. "So you're married?" "For 13 years. Owen raised his eyebrows. 25 wasn't young to be a bride in most of the country, but it was among her friends and probably his too. Before he could comment on it, Sarah hurried to change the subject. "How about you?" He put his hands in his pockets and shook his head. "No one could ever live up to you," he said. His tone was teasing, but his expression was serious. And Sarah had stood there not knowing what to say. When Sarah had been little, she'd had a fantasy of being constantly observed, watched by an invisible but surely vast audience as the star of the story of her own life, a story that someone else had already written and that it was her job to perform. Here's Sarah on her first day of school walking into her new classroom. Who will be her friends? Here's Sarah on soccer team tryout day. Here she is at her piano recital. Here she is in the cafeteria at school. With every new development in her life, she would imagine an audience watching with approval or shock or delight. When she performed in front of an audience for the first time at her first recital, she felt, instead of stage fright, a click of recognition. Ah, she thought, looking out at the assembled faces as they waited for her to begin. There they are. Even as she imagined the audience, Sarah also pictured herself as an observer, that she was both the star and someone waiting to see how the action would unfold. Oh, she'd think to herself, so that's what happens next. Was this then what happened next? Sarah leaves her joyless marriage to reconnect with her old flame? Or was this a test? Was she meant to renounce Owen and recommit to her family, to her boys, and to Ruby, who loved her and needed her? Hey, Owen said. He reached for her hand, then seemed to think better of it. Are you rushing off somewhere? Do you have time for a coffee? Sarah imagined her audience, invisible and attentive, watching and waiting for her decision. Not today, she said. A refusal then, but not an absolute one. She'd closed the door for now, but she'd left it unlocked. Owen nodded at the business card. Well, now you've got my number. Give me a call if you want. He took a step toward her, close enough for her to appreciate, once more, the otherworldly blue of his eyes, and brushed his lips against her cheek. She smelled what must have been cologne or aftershave, layered over the scent that she remembered, the one that was just soap and Owen's skin. It was good to see you, Sarah. You too, she'd said, and she'd walked to the subway, then home with her heart pounding, her fingers returning over and over to the spot on her cheek where he'd kissed her. Sarah Levy Weinberg had heard about the Lassiters before she'd met them. Her mother referred to them, and to all the families with houses in the woods of Wellfleet and Truro, as the Pond People. She'd heard her parents discussing them at parties, when talking she and Sam would sneak out of their beds and up to the kitchen. They'd ease the sliding door open and tiptoe onto the half-moon-shaped deck, where they would watch and hear the grown-ups below them, gathered around the glowing turquoise rectangle of the pool. Wasps, snobs, anti-Semites. They think they own the Outer Cape, and they don't like it when people like us show up, she'd heard her mom telling her Aunt Suzanne, who'd crinkled her nose and said, Are you sure they just don't like you? Sarah first encountered the Pond People when she was 7. It was the first summer she and Sam had managed to swim all the way across Gull Pond, with her mother swimming with them, encouraging them, letting them tread water and catch their breath while they held onto her shoulders. Every few strokes, Sarah would lift her head and squint at the shoreline. In the distance, through the reeds, she could see a house. At first, it was just a blur, but as she got closer, she could see it in more detail. A one-story building with a shingled roof and red paint, set on a little rise behind the shore, with a splintery wooden dock sticking out like a stubby finger into the water. Sarah swam and swam for what felt like forever, and the reeds in the house shoreline never seemed to get nearer until finally, in tiny increments, she could feel the water growing warmer, could see it changing color. First, she felt the tickle of reeds against her feet, and then, a few strokes later, she could just brush the sand on the bottom with her toes. A minute later, Sam came up behind her, gasping and splashing. Rest for a few minutes, said their mom, who wasn't out of breath at all. Then we'll start back. Sarah felt, before she saw, that there was someone watching them. She looked past her mother's head, and she saw a boy on the shore. He seemed to be about her age. He was barefoot, dressed in faded blue swim trunks and nothing else. His skin was deeply tanned. His hair was dark brown, almost black, and he was staring at them. No, he was scowling at them. "Good morning," her mother called, her voice loud and cheerful as she waved hello. The boy's scowl didn't change.
"This is private property," he called, in a carrying voice.
Behind her, Sam was paddling noisily, breathing hard, as the screen door slammed and a woman's voice called, "Owen, is someone there?" Beside her, Sarah's mother rolled her eyes. "Are you ready?" Sarah wasn't actually ready, and her mom ended up towing her and her brother the final 200 yards or so back to the public beach. After she'd dried off and her brother was flopped, face down and panting on a towel in the sun, Sarah asked her mom, "Why did that boy say it was private property?" "It's not," her mother said absently. She was sitting in her folding chair, in her wide-brimmed sun hat and her big sunglasses, already engrossed in her book. "The shoreline might be, but the water itself isn't anyone's property." "So why'd that boy say it was?"
"He's been misinformed," her mother said.
She closed her book, her finger marking her place. Sam didn't lift his head, but Sarah could tell that he was listening. "Bottom line is, you're allowed to swim in any part of the pond you want to. It isn't theirs, no matter what they say." The next time Sarah saw the boy was later that summer in Wellfleet, at an ice cream parlor in the center of town. This was their Sunday night tradition. They'd go out to dinner somewhere, Moby Dick's or PJ's, if the kids prevailed, Ciro and Sal's or the Abbey in Provincetown, if Ronnie and Lee had their way. And they'd always stop somewhere for a cone for dessert. Sarah and Sam had just joined the line when Sarah spotted the boy, almost at the window, standing with a slender woman dressed in an oversized men's shirt, the sleeves rolled up, tied at the waist above a pair of white jeans. The woman's hair was streaky blonde, twisted in a knot at the nape of her neck. She wore sunglasses even though the sun was almost down, and a swipe of bright pink lipstick, which caught Sarah's eye. Her mother never wore makeup in the summertime. There was an older girl, too, who seemed to be maybe 11 or 12, with dark hair and a ponytail, shoulders hunched in a forest green sweatshirt. Sarah recognized the boy's scowl. When she got close enough to see his face, Sarah added to her impression brilliant blue eyes, a color between azure and turquoise, the bluest eyes she'd ever seen. "Three skinny cones," the woman said to the girl behind the counter, in a husky smoker's voice. Her lipstick, Sarah saw, matched the rubber thong of her flip-flops.
"Can I get a sundae?" asked the girl.
"You don't need hot fudge," said the woman, without looking at her daughter. "What does Mare always say? 1 minute on the lips, a lifetime on the hips."
Sarah could feel her own mother's disapproval as the girl stared down at the ground, chewing on her bottom lip. Once they were at the front of the line, Sarah's mother said, in a voice louder than was necessary, "Sam and Sarah, you can get anything you want." Sam's eyes were wide. Before their mom could change her mind, he ordered a hot fudge sundae, and Sarah got a black and white frap with whipped cream and a cherry, which she drank so fast she ended up with an ice cream headache, her stomach unsettled from all the sugar. She'd looked for the boy at the metal tables where people sat with their desserts, and on Main Street, and in the parking lot, but he and his family were gone. Sarah didn't see the boy again that summer, although sometimes on her trips across the pond, she'd see other people around the red house with the peeling paint. She spotted the woman and the girl once on the porch. Another time, she saw the woman and a man her father's age. The woman's hair was loose, and she was smoking a cigarette, gesturing with her free hand. The man stood in front of her, his body menacingly close.
Sarah could tell without hearing a word that they were fighting, and she wondered where the boy was and if he was listening. Her next sighting came years later when she was 14. She swam across the pond on a Saturday morning in late August, and there was the boy, shirtless again, dragging a net on a pole through the water. A big yellow dog sat on the sand beside him. The boy's skin was the same deep nut brown it had been the first time she'd seen him. And he wore another faded bathing suit, this one red. He'd gotten taller, and his shoulders were broader, his forearms lean and corded with tendons that shifted beneath his skin as he moved the net. She could see a dusting of dark hair on his calves. He lifted his head as Sarah approached. She kept her distance, treading water, waiting to see if he'd yell at her. Instead, he just looked out across the water, his face expressionless. "What are you trying to catch?" she finally called. He looked down at the net as if surprised to find it in his hands. "I don't actually know," he said, and shrugged. "I just found this in the boathouse." He raised the pole and lifted the dripping net up and out of the water so that Sarah could see a hole in the netting. "It's ripped." Before she could ask why he was wasting time dragging a torn net through the water, the boy said, "I was bored." He smiled, and it transformed his face, turning it from sullen to almost painfully handsome. He waded out into the pond until he was knee-deep in the water, which reflected rippling sunlight into his bright blue eyes. Sarah could hear the water lapping at the shore, and the sound of raised voices, a man's deep voice and a woman shouting shrilly back. The boy glanced over his shoulder, looking uncomfortable. "Do you know how to canoe?" he asked. "Yeah," said Sarah, who'd been on dozens of canoe trips through the marshes in her years at Audubon Camp. "Wanna go?" "Okay." Sarah walked slowly out of the water. That summer, she'd been newly aware of her body. She braced herself for the kind of scrutiny she'd gotten familiar with at school. But the boy just set the ripped net and pole down on the sand and handed her a folded, threadbare towel. "My name's Owen," he said. "I'm Sarah." The towel felt warm from being left in the sun. Sarah wrapped it around her waist as the boy set off. "Cool. Come on, we'll get the canoe." He whistled and the dog got to its feet, following them as Owen led her past the house, with its scabby paint and splintery wooden railings and the sounds of fighting still through its opened windows, to a boxy one-room concrete structure with the right side of its shingled roof almost completely caved in. "This is the boathouse," he announced. "What happened?" Sarah asked, looking uneasily at the roof. "Tree fell," Owen said, nonchalantly. "Is it safe?" she asked. Owen scratched at a mosquito bite on his arm. "I guess so. I mean, the roof hasn't fallen in so far." Inside, the only illumination came from a single light bulb on a string. Owen tugged it, and Sarah peered around the cobwebby dimness. She could make out a pair of canoes, a few paddles, a bicycle missing its front wheel, and a tennis racket that needed restringing. A volleyball net sagged against the wall next to a few rusty metal-legged beach chairs. At Owen's direction, Sarah helped lift one of the canoes and carry it out to the beach. Sarah considered asking for a life jacket, which her mother always made her wear, then decided not to. The dog, whose name was Hopper, leaped into the center of the canoe and sat there, looking dignified and a little bored. Owen held the canoe steady as Sarah took the seat at the back of the boat. He towed the canoe out until he was knee-deep in the water before gracefully jumping up and in. He dipped his paddle, first left, then right, and Sarah matched her strokes to his as they started gliding toward the opposite shore. Sarah learned that Owen lived in Westport, Connecticut, and he attended boarding school in Rhode Island. His parents were divorced, and both were remarried, and he spent every summer with his mother, Sass, and his stepfather, Anders, on the Cape.
Me too, she said. I mean, not the divorce part, but we're here all summer.
Do you live in Wellfleet?
Truro.
Sarah couldn't see his face, but she could watch his back and arms and shoulders, the play of muscles beneath his skin. It was a hot day. The sky was cloudless and blue, with a breeze stirring the tops of the tall pine trees that circled the pond. A sunfish with a yellow and white sail tacked across the water. A few other canoers paddled along the shoreline. On the public beach, on the other side of the pond, little kids were splashing around in the shallows, while older kids sunned themselves or cannonballed off the raft.
"Do you have brothers or sisters?" Owen asked.
"One brother. He's my twin, but I'm older." Even at 14, that felt important to mention.
"And you've got a sister, right?"
"How'd you know?"
"I saw you in Wellfleet at the ice cream place."
Owen nodded. "I saw you in P-Town once. I go to sailing camp there."
"I didn't know there were any camps in P-Town."
"Yep." Owen didn't seem like he was going to say any more, and Sarah found herself babbling to fill up the silence.
"My mom called you guys the pond people."
As soon as it was out of her mouth, Sarah wished she hadn't said it. It had sounded funny when her mother used the term. Out loud, to an actual pond person, it just sounded insulting. She was about to apologize when Owen turned around, grinning.
"Pond people. That's pretty good.
And I guess we're the bay people?"
"Ha," Owen said, sounding less amused. He turned around again, giving Sarah his back. "No, you're the rich people."
That shocked her into silence, as if rich were a curse word, something you couldn't say out loud. She'd never thought of her family as rich, although she guessed that probably they were. But if Owen went to boarding school and sailing camp and spent his summers here, wasn't he rich too? And if that was the case, why did his house look like it was falling down?
"I don't think my parents are really rich. My mom's a professor and my dad's a lawyer," Sarah said.
When Owen didn't volunteer any more information, Sarah asked, "What do your parents do?"
"Well," Owen paused, seeming to gather himself.
"My real dad's a stockbroker. He lives in Manhattan. Anders is between jobs at the moment."
From the clipped way he spoke, Sarah guessed that Owen was quoting someone, probably his mother.
"And Sass doesn't work. Well, she does house stuff, and she gets married. I guess that's her job."
Sarah barely knew where to start. She could understand that being married might count as a job, the same way being a mother was. But how did getting married qualify as work?
"You call your mother by her first name?" was what she finally decided to ask.
Owen dipped his paddle smoothly in and out of the water.
"Her real name is Ballard Moreland. Then she was Ballard Moreland Lassiter, and now it's Ballard Moreland Lassiter Rehnquist. But everyone calls her Sass."
He back-paddled to steer them around a fallen log.
"Oh," said Sarah. "How about your sister?"
"She's 16. She's working on the vineyard this year. Her name's Eliza, but everyone calls her Bump."
"Why Bump?"
"Because she used to bump her head against her crib when she was a baby."
"Do you have a nickname?"
"Yep." Sarah waited for a few strokes.
"Will you tell me what it is?"
"Nope."
"Oh, come on."
Sarah used the edge of her paddle to flick water at him. Owen turned around. He splashed her back and gave her a smile that made her heart do strange, swoopy things.
"Someday. Maybe."
For the rest of the afternoon, Sarah and Owen paddled around the pond talking. Sarah learned that Owen was 14, like she was. She learned about his favorite food, pizza with sausage and onions, and which TV shows he liked, ER and Law and Order. She found out his favorite musicians, Outkast and Eminem, and what he was planning to do with the rest of his summer, attend sailing camp in P-Town. then go back to school a week early when lacrosse practice began. When Sarah told Owen that she'd taken piano lessons since she was six and that her current teacher was on the faculty at the Berklee College of Music, he sounded impressed.
Are you really good? I guess you must be.
I practice a lot, said Sarah, which was true. It was also true that she was beginning to wonder if she was good enough to be a concert pianist. When she was little, her teachers had been effusive, telling her parents that she had innate musicianship, that she was gifted. Now they said that she needed to apply herself, that if she was serious about making a life as a musician, she needed to practice at least 3 hours a day, and ideally even more than that, at least 6 days a week. That kind of schedule didn't leave time for anything besides sleep and homework, and Sarah wasn't sure if she loved music enough to persist, to give up everything else and devote herself completely to the piano. The first time they approached the public beach, Sarah called to her mother, who walked down to the shore, peering at them from underneath the hand she'd raised to her brow. "New friend?" she called, and Sarah felt her face get hot. "Mom, this is Owen. Owen, this is my mom."
"Hi," said Owen, with a wave.
"Nice to meet you, Owen."
"Sarah, you should put on more sunscreen," said her mom.
"I'm fine," she said, and wished her mother hadn't made it sound like she was still a little kid. They'd gone paddling off, waving every time they came close to shore. After their fourth circuit of the pond, Veronica stood up and pointed meaningfully at her wrist, where a watch would have been if she'd worn one.
"I think I have to go."
Sarah didn't want to leave him, didn't want this day to end, but could already feel the skin of her shoulders tightening with incipient sunburn. She'd pay for her refusal to put on the sunscreen her mom had offered. Worth it, she decided. Owen paddled them up to the shore until Sarah could feel the bottom of the canoe scrape against the sand. He held the boat steady with one hand and extended his other one out to her. She took his hand and climbed down, unfolding her legs, which had gotten stiff during the hours they'd been on the pond. This was fun. Owen nodded as he stood in the water, scratching Hopper behind his ears. She wondered if she should ask for his phone number or propose a plan for the weekend, but before she could decide, Owen said, "See ya," and pushed the boat back into the water, hopping into it and paddling away. On Sunday, then Monday and Tuesday, Sarah swam across the pond and waited, treading water across from the red house. But she never saw Owen or anyone else, and she was too shy to walk out of the water and knock on the door. On Wednesday, Sarah's dad drove her back home to Boston, and 2 days after that, they went to the Berkshires, where she'd be attending music camp at Tanglewood for the last 2 weeks of her summer vacation. She didn't see Owen again for the next 3 years, and in that time, she met other boys, boys whose smile or touch made her heart beat faster. But she never forgot about Owen. At odd moments of her day or in her bed at night, she would find herself remembering his smile, his brilliant blue eyes, something he'd said, the muscles flexing and tendons flickering in his legs as he'd hopped into the canoe. Sarah spent her last year of high school trying to decide if she'd go to a conservatory, aiming at the small chance of fame and fortune, or if she'd take the more reasonable path of a liberal arts degree. Her parents left it up to her, telling her they'd pay for her education no matter where she decided to go. Her teacher encouraged her. "You have enough talent to do this," Mr. Ascarelli said. "All you have to decide is whether or not you've got the drive. And you have to decide if you'll have regrets for the rest of your life if you don't try." She'd asked him about his classmates from Oberlin, where he'd studied. "Well, let's see," he said, removing his eyeglasses and polishing them on his sleeve. "One of them recorded 3 CDs by the time he was 30 and has performed with orchestras all over the world.
Another one works on Broadway, playing keyboard in the pit for different musicals. He was even on stage for a while with Cabaret, where the ensemble was part of the show. He sighed and put his glasses back on. And I've got one who gives lessons out of her house in Texarkana to little kids. And one plays music in the cocktail lounge on a cruise ship, he'd added. This hadn't helped Sarah make up her mind. Back and forth she went, all year long, as January 15, the deadline for applications, approached. She'd finally decided on Wellesley.
If you hate it, or if you miss music, you can always change your mind, her mom said, right after Sarah had submitted her application. Nothing has to be forever.
She'd been accepted. Her parents had sent in a deposit. That summer, Sarah, at her mother's insistence, got a job as a maid in a hotel in Provincetown, down the street from the shop where Sam sold penny candy to tourists. Her mother was a great believer in the value of working in the service industry. You'll learn how to deal with customers and with a boss, and you'll give waitresses good tips for the rest of your life. At the end of June, Sarah had been walking down Commercial Street at the end of her shift when a male voice had called her name. She'd turned, and there was Owen, taller, broader through his chest, in khaki shorts, a dark blue t-shirt, and boat shoes.
"Sarah!"
She'd smiled at him. "Do you know this is the first time I've seen you with a shirt on?" He looked down at himself, then did a model's spin. "So, what do you think?" "Blue is definitely your color." "Are you here for the summer?" he asked. She nodded. "Want to go canoeing again?" Sarah tried not to smile as widely as she wanted to, tried not to show how delighted she was that he'd remembered her and wanted to see her again.
"Sure."
Owen told her how to find his house from the land instead of the water. "Turn left off Route 6, right before Moby Dick's on Rose Road. There's a dirt road on the right-hand side. It's pretty bumpy and rutted, but if you go slow, you'll be fine. Just follow it around until you see the camp." He told her he was also working as a counselor at the Provincetown Yacht Club, the sailing camp he'd attended, and as a barback at a restaurant with an expansive outdoor deck right on Commercial Street, a place that did a booming business from brunch, which began at 10 a.m., through last call at 2 in the morning. "The food's not great, but they've got cheap drinks," Owen said. Between their jobs, Owen and Sarah didn't have a lot of free time that overlapped, but whenever they did that summer, they would kayak or ride their bikes along the path into Eastham or Orleans, or walk the paths through the dunes, gathering cranberries and wineberries and wild blueberries. They swam in the pond and in the bay and in the ocean. At night, they'd build bonfires on the beaches and roast hot dogs and clams and ears of corn. Their romance unfolded slowly and sweetly, each milestone marked in Sarah's mind. The first time they held hands, the first time Owen kissed her, and the first time she felt his hands on her breasts as she lay on a towel on the cooling sand, with a bonfire warming her face and the wind whispering through the dune grass. 2 weeks after their reunion, Sarah brought Owen home for dinner on the 4th of July. She led him past the pool and through the front door. She pulled the sliding door shut, calling, "Mom, we're here," and walking upstairs to the kitchen. When she realized Owen wasn't behind her, she turned around to find him standing perfectly still, with his eyes closed and an expression suggesting he'd just seen the face of God. Sarah raised her eyebrows. "What?" she asked. "Air conditioning," he whispered back ecstatically. Sarah saw that he was standing right over one of the vents. It had been hot and humid all week, the temperature soaring into the upper 80s every day, rarely dipping below 70 degrees at night. Every evening, heat lightning would illuminate the sky in flashes, but the rain never came, and the weather never broke. Sarah was used to the air conditioning. From his expression, she could see that Owen clearly was not. Then her mom called, "Come on up, Dinner's ready. And Owen left his spot over the vent and came upstairs, where he joined the rest of the guests, two other families that had homes near theirs. Sarah watched as he introduced himself, shaking her mom's hand, then her dad's. At sunset, everyone gathered in the living room. Sarah's mom pressed a button to roll up the blinds, kept down during the day so the room would stay cool, and they sat on the couch for the ritual of oohing and aahing at the sunset. Her dad grilled steaks and Vidalia onions. Her mom steamed corn and served her watermelon and feta cheese salad. Owen spread his napkin on his lap. He cut his steak into slivers and talked to Sam about sports and answered all her parents' questions, telling them he was going to Duke, where he planned to study history and play lacrosse, where he'd live with other freshmen on the East Campus, in a house called Pegram. Sarah could see him looking around at the bookcases that lined the living room wall, at the paintings on the walls, at the gleaming kitchen. She guessed it was different from his house, if the insides matched the outsides, and wondered how her house looked to him, whether he thought it was pleasant or ostentatious. At the end of the night, Owen and Sarah walked down to the beach and sat together on a blanket, watching as the waves came foaming gently onto the sand. Owen was in a quiet mood, staring out at the sea, stroking her hair almost absently. "What?" she finally asked. "Is something wrong?" He shook his head and gave her a tight-lipped smile that was nothing like his usual easy grin. "I was just thinking how long it's been since I sat down at a table for an actual meal where nobody yelled at anyone or threw anything." Sarah was startled. "Do people throw things at your house?" she asked, then thought of something worse. "Are they not feeding you?" He squeezed her hand. "No, no, there's food. There's just not, you know, meals with vegetables and side dishes and setting the table. And it's less about the throwing things than the yelling." He sighed and picked up a piece of driftwood and used it to trace patterns in the sand. "So, what are meals like?" Owen shrugged. "My mom doesn't eat much." He gave another tight smile. "She says it's harder to get a buzz on if your stomach's full." Sarah must have looked shocked. Was Sass an alcoholic? Before she could figure out how to ask, Owen shook his head at her expression. "It's not that bad. Anders and I fend for ourselves. There's frozen pizzas and chicken nuggets, and most nights somebody's grilling on the beach. We're scavengers." With that, he grinned, baring his teeth, grabbing Sarah by the shoulders, rolling her onto her back, nibbling at her neck in a way that always made her shiver. Sarah closed her eyes, holding him tight. And it wasn't until later, after Owen had gone home and she was alone in her bed, that she thought about what he'd said and what he hadn't said. She'd never been introduced to anyone in Owen's family, had never been invited to a meal, had barely spent any time at the camp, which was what Owen called the collection of three buildings where the Lassiter clan stayed in the summertime. The largest building, called Papa Bear, was the house with scabrous red paint. It had a kitchen and a living room, two bedrooms, and a screened-in porch. Mama Bear was a one-room cabin, with, Owen told her, a double bed and a set of bunk beds crammed inside. Baby Bear, the smallest building, hardly had room for a twin bed and a dresser. It was still the spot Owen and his sister preferred, and the only building where Sarah could claim to be familiar with the inside as well as the outside. "But why?" Sarah asked, after Owen showed her where he slept. "Don't you get claustrophobic?" She would have felt like she was sleeping in an elevator if she had to spend a night there. Owen had shrugged. "It's farther away from the big house," he said. "And the fighting," Sarah thought. In addition to the three bears, there was the boathouse, its roof still unrepaired, slumped in on itself like a toothless mouth. There was also a bathhouse, which boasted a single toilet and an old-fashioned sink in a cinder block enclosure. The bathing facilities consisted of a showerhead nailed up on a tree, with a flimsy plastic curtain hung on the tree's branches and a gesture toward privacy. Owen had told her that his mother got up early and took a bar of soap and a container of shampoo into the pond, where she took her bath. "Is that okay for the pond?" Sarah asked, and Owen had shrugged and said, "I don't think Sass is much of an environmentalist." The whole setup was very different from the Levy-Weinberg house, where there was a pool and a hot tub, where each of the four bedrooms had its own bathroom, where there was a caretaker employed year-round and a handyman on call, where every meal featured all four food groups, and where anything broken was immediately repaired or replaced. Finally, in the middle of August, Owen brought Sarah to a bonfire on the beach. That was where she met his mother, at last. Sass gave Sarah a cool, limp-fingered handshake. Her lips painted the same shade of hot pink lipstick that Sarah remembered, lingering over the syllables of Sarah's last name. Sarah Levy Weinberg. "You're Veronica Levy's daughter." Sass turned to one of the other women Sarah had been introduced to. There'd been, she remembered, a Mimsy and a Bunny and a woman named Lawrence, and said, "Veronica Levy, the novelist," in a tone that turned novelist into what sounded like an insult. "Eat before you go," Sarah's mom had told her. "If it's like any WASP party I've ever been to, there's going to be oceans of booze and not a thing to eat." Once Sarah escaped from Sass, she walked down the beach, weaving through the clusters of people looking around. On a card table draped in a plastic tablecloth that flapped in the breeze, she saw plastic bags of tortilla chips and potato chips, a plastic jug of cheese balls and a container of onion dip. There were jars of salsa and honey-roasted peanuts, and a paper plate with hamburgers and hot dogs. So not a complete absence of food, but there definitely wasn't as much as there would have been if her parents were hosting. And the card table that held the booze did seem extremely well-stocked. Most of the party crowd was clustered around it, squeezing chunks of lime into plastic cups of gin and tonic or opening beers. Sarah could hear Sass's shrill laughter. She saw Owen's mother with her head thrown back, throat exposed, streaky blonde hair blowing in the night breeze, her hand resting lightly on the forearm of a man who wasn't her husband as she talked. Owen got Sarah a burger, a handful of salt and vinegar potato chips, and a soda, doctored with a shot of rum, and they sat on the sun-warm dunes to slap at the mosquitoes. When the fire was burning low, he led her into the darkness. They lay down together, and without a word, he turned to kiss her. Usually, Owen talked to her. "Can I kiss you?" he'd murmur into her ear. "Is this okay?" That night, he was silent and intent, his hands possessive, almost fierce. When they broke apart, he pulled back to rest his forehead against hers, gazing into her eyes. Sarah knew what he was asking, and she nodded, thinking, "Yes, please." Whatever she could give him, love, comfort, even just a distraction, she would. They had felt inevitable. Everything they'd done, everything they'd told each other, as they'd progressed from kissing to making out to everything but. Finally, on the Wednesday before Labor Day, when they'd both be going home and then to college, Owen had taken Sarah to Slough Pond, and she dared him to swim the butterfly across it, and he'd said, "What will you give me if I do it?" Once he'd won the bet and carried her out of the water, he'd spread his towel on the pine needles, laid Sarah on top of it, and stripped off her swimsuit with something like reverence, kissing up from the arches of her insteps to her ankles, to the soft, ticklish flesh behind her knees, kissing and nibbling higher and higher until her thighs fell apart, and she found her hands fisted in his hair. "Show me," he'd whispered. "Show me what you like." She'd been so ashamed, She'd always imagined this part happening in a bed, in the dark, not out here in the bright midday sunshine, where anyone could come down the path and see. But Owen had been insistent. "Don't worry," he'd murmured in her ear. "No one can see us, and no one ever comes here. Do you trust me?" Sarah had nodded. "Then show me. Let me make you feel good." Face flaming, she'd squeezed her eyes shut, letting one hand slip down her belly, letting her fingertips stroke first gently, then faster. Owen, it turned out, was a quick learner, or maybe this was a thing he'd already learned with other girls. She would have dwelled on that thought, only Owen's fingers and lips and tongue soon had her in a state where she couldn't hold on to any thought at all. When she'd cried out, at the height of her pleasure, a blue jay had burst from the tree above them, chattering and scolding as it flew off. Owen had laughed and wiped his face. Then he'd pulled a condom out of his pocket and looked at Sarah. "Okay?" he'd asked, his eyes steady on hers. "We don't have to. Not unless you want to." "Yes," she'd said. "I do. I want to. Please." She hadn't regretted it. Not any of it. Not even the night before she'd left, when she'd ridden her bike to the camp to say goodbye to Owen. She'd been walking down the rutted road toward Papa Bear when she'd heard Sass, her voice bright and cutting, talking to one of her friends. "Is he still seeing that girl?" the friend had asked. Sarah held herself still, trying not to move, not to blink. "For now," said Sass in her drawling voice. Sarah saw a bluish curl of cigarette smoke snaking through the ripped screens. "He's besotted." Sass sounded amused at the idea of her son being besotted with Sarah, who held herself perfectly still. Part of her wanted to make noise, to call out a greeting so Sass would stop talking. Another part, a more persuasive part, wanted to hear more. "And her mother's a novelist, right?" asked the friend. "Uh-huh. Hasn't published anything in years, but she must have done quite well. Owen says they live in one of those..." Sarah could imagine Sass gesturing with her cigarette, her bright pink lip curled. "Show places up on the dunes." The word "show places" was freighted with just as much scorn as besotted had been. The friend said something Sarah couldn't hear, to which Sass replied, "Well, those people know how to hold on to their pennies." She'd laughed a tinkling, breaking glass laugh and said, "Maybe Miss Weinberg will be the one to save us all." Those people. Sarah's hands had felt icy. Her lips, still swollen from Owen's kisses, had stung as if she'd been slapped. Was that why Owen was with her? Part of her wanted to deny it, utterly and completely. Another part remembered the first thing Owen had told her about his mom, how she treated getting married like it was her job. Maybe he'd inherited his mother's worldview. Maybe he did see Sarah as a means to an end, the one who would rescue his family. Fiercely, Sarah told herself to forget what she'd heard. She'd gotten moving again, striding down the path, making as much noise as she could, calling Owen's name, and Owen had come running out of Little Bear, smiling just for her. They'd spent the afternoon at Ballston Beach, riding the waves, then they'd gone to the drive-in, then back to the beach. As midnight and Sarah's curfew approached, they'd made love again, with the sound of the wind and the waves in their ears, and hundreds of stars burning in the sky above them. "I love you," Sarah whispered, so low that Owen could pretend he hadn't heard. He'd put his thumb beneath her chin, lifting her head for a kiss, and she'd thought her heart would burst wide open when he'd said, "I love you too." The next morning, Owen went home. "I'll email you my phone number as soon as I get to school," he'd said. Only instead of a phone number, 5 days into her tenure at Wellesley, she'd gotten a breakup letter, or rather a breakup email
from Owen's AOL account. I've met someone here, and I want to be with her. I'm sorry, but it's for the best. We should both be free. She'd written back immediately, begging him to call, to explain it to her, to give her a chance, but he hadn't, and she didn't have a number to reach him at school. After 2 days of crying, she'd called information in Connecticut, thinking she'd reach SAS and beg for Owen's number. But when she'd tried, a computerized voice told her there was no such listing, not for Owen's mother or his stepfather or any combination of their many first and last names. The same voice gave her the same bad news when she'd tried to find a listing for the family camp on the Cape. She'd held out hope for 9 months, but when she'd finally come back to Cape Cod after her freshman year, when she'd made her first trip across the pond that summer, the camp was abandoned. The buildings razed, nothing left where they'd been but holes in the ground. Owen and his entire family had disappeared. That night, Sarah lay in bed with the brownstones silent around her, trying not to think about those summers. The boys were sleeping, one floor above her. Eli, presumably, was one floor above them, tucked into Ruby's old bed. Sarah rolled over onto her left side and shut her eyes. She flipped to her right side, then onto her back, where she stared helplessly at the ceiling. She counted backward from 100. She played scales in her head, from C major to A flat minor. Finally, she swung her legs out of bed, earning an irritated look from Lord Farquaad, who'd been snoozing on Eli's side of the bed, which, in Eli's absence, he'd claimed for himself. "Apologies, Your Highness," she muttered, and grabbed her purse off the chair. Owen's card was in her wallet, tucked in deep, behind ticket stubs from shows she'd seen with Ruby, receipts from the dry cleaners, and loyalty punch cards from the place she'd gotten her manicures before the pandemic. She typed in his number and tapped out a text. "I'd love to get that coffee sometime this week." When she woke up the next morning to the sound of the boys getting themselves dressed overhead, there was a text waiting. "Thursday afternoon, any good? Can you meet at the Guggenheim? I could use some culture." Sarah felt the strangest tangle of emotions, hope and sorrow and guilt and excitement all twisted together as she tapped her answer. "Yes." Eli. In the months since his banishment, Eli had developed a routine. He'd wait until he heard the soft chirp of their home alarm, the front door opening and closing as Sarah left for her morning walk. Then he'd collect his belongings and slink down to the bedroom before the boys could wake up and see him. On a Monday morning, he'd just finished shaving when his brain informed him that there was less than a month until Ruby's wedding, and he found himself gripping the sink and groaning out loud. "Eli?" He hadn't heard Sarah returning, but he could hear her now through the bathroom door, sounding worried. "Everything okay?" He put on his hearty, jolly voice. "Fine," he called, as he opened his eyes and stared at his reflection in the steamy mirror. He still looked, to his own eyes, normal and not like a man who moved through his days a single heartbeat away from a scream. "Everything's fine." But of course, nothing was fine, and he was, he knew, running out of time to come up with a solution. That morning, at work, he waited until his office manager had gone to lunch. Then he opened an anonymous browser on her laptop, too afraid to use an anonymous browser on his own, and Googled DNA paternity tests. Judging from the bloom of ads and links, Eli wasn't the first person to do a search on this particular subject. He chose a link at random and clicked. Beneath a picture of a beaming white man embracing an adorably chubby-cheeked toddler was text reading, "If you choose the private test option, a painless buccal swab, mouth swab, collection kit will be sent directly to you for sample collection in the privacy of your own home." Great, he thought.
and imagined handing Gabe the kit. After dinner, maybe, while they were all together. Him and Sarah and Dexter and Miles and Ruby and Gabe watching a movie. "Hey, Gabe, mind giving me a few epithelial cells?" "Oh, no special reason, just curious." Okay, then. He'd find an excuse to go to Gabe and Ruby's place. He'd take Gabe's toothbrush. Except how would he know which one was Gabe's? Fine, he'd take both the toothbrushes. He'd take all the toothbrushes. He'd show up with replacement toothbrushes, an early wedding gift. He'd bring a bottle of champagne, and he'd ask them the last time they'd replaced their toothbrushes. And he'd give them the new ones and leave with the old ones. Maybe he could even give Ruby a blue toothbrush for her something blue. Except, of course, Ruby would be suspicious, and Eli had never been good at lying to his daughter. There was, of course, an obvious solution. Tell Sarah the truth. Tell Ruby the truth. But then Eli imagined his daughter, her face flushed with anger, mouth turned down, hair disordered and frizzy, because when she was anxious, she'd take it out of its bun, then rewrap it, then take it out again, over and over. "You cheated on Mom when she was pregnant with me?" Then he pictured Sarah, the way she went pale when she was upset, the way her chin jutted out and her back got very straight. "You have another child?" Maybe he could wait until Shabbat, keep track of the silverware that Gabe used, and send in his fork or his spoon. Would that work? Could the labs find the DNA in the midst of particles of roast chicken and gravy? "Fuck," he hissed. His office manager, who'd just come through the door, stared at him, her eyes very big behind her glasses. Eli made himself smile. "Lost at solitaire," he said, and she'd nodded, still looking concerned. The even more obvious solution was to just ask Gabe's mother to tell him the truth. "Did you and I have sex in New York City? Did you have a baby instead of an abortion? Am I Gabe's father?" Except Gabe's mother had turned herself into something like a ghost. "No, my mom doesn't do social media," Gabe said when Eli asked casually if his mom had announced their engagement on her Facebook page. Eli had already looked on Instagram and LinkedIn and Twitter and couldn't find her anywhere. But Rosa had an email address. Everyone had an email address. She had a phone number, too, which Gabe was happy to provide when Sarah insisted that they FaceTime his mom and introduce themselves. Eli's heart had almost stopped when Sarah proposed it. Then he realized maybe it was a good thing. Maybe he'd see Gabe's mother on screen and know for sure that she wasn't the woman who'd called herself Jane. Or maybe she'd see him and recognize him and reach out on her own, and they'd figure out how to fix things together. Eli made sure to be in front of the camera, completely visible during the call. He'd even tried to grow the goatee he'd worn back then, because Rosa would have remembered him with facial hair, except with 5 days' notice he hadn't been able to produce more than a sad, straggling mustache and a few wisps of beard. "Could you please shave?" Sarah had asked the night of the phone call. "Please, you'll have plenty of time to grow a beard before the wedding, but right now you look homeless." "You're not supposed to say that," Dexter called from his spot in the living room, where he and his brother were building a Lego Death Star. "What's that?" Eli asked. "Homeless. We learned that in school. You're not supposed to call people that. You're supposed to say housing insecure." "Got it," said Sarah, leaving Eli thinking, not for the first time, how in the end he'd probably have kids who could instruct him on the 70 reasons he should be driving an electric car, but couldn't find their own state on a map. Eli had shaved. He spent the entire afternoon and evening before the call feeling like he was going to vomit, or scream and vomit at the same time. When the table was cleared and the FaceTime began, he braced himself for the sight of his old lover again, preparing for Rose's wide eyes, her look of recognition, the horrified expression on her face that would match the horrified way that he felt. But when the call finally happened, it was more bad news. Rosa was Jane,
Eli saw it immediately. Her hair was still dark, her skin still that glowing golden bronze that Eli remembered, and she had the same dark brows, the same dark-eyed, direct stare. "Hello, Rosa," Eli said into the camera of Gabe's phone. "It's wonderful to meet you." He saw, or maybe he just thought he saw, her eyes widen incrementally, her mouth fall open for just an instant. Then that look of recognition, if it had been recognition, was gone, and Rosa was saying, "It's nice to meet you, too. Thank you for making Gabe feel so welcome." "Of course," Sarah said. "Gabe's a sweetheart. We've enjoyed having him." "Yes," Rosa said quietly. "Gabe's a good boy." Sarah said that they were all looking forward to seeing her. Rosa said again how grateful she was that they'd given Gabe a home during the pandemic. Sarah praised Gabe's kindness with Dexter and Miles. "Not to get ahead of ourselves, but he's going to be a wonderful father." Eli's stomach lurched as Sarah and Rosa smiled at each other, as more pleasantries were exchanged, more plans were made, and finally, the call concluded. Later that night, Eli quietly asked Gabe for his mother's number, "just so Sarah and I know how to reach her." But when he called, the calls went straight to voicemail. He tried texting. "Hi, Rosa, this is Eli Danhauser, Ruby's dad. I'd love to talk to you for a minute." Nothing. "Rosa, it's Eli Danhauser again. Please call me when you can." Nothing. "Rosa, it's Eli Danhauser. I really need to speak to you. Please call. It's important." Nothing. Maybe she's avoiding me, he thought, then laughed at himself. Obviously, she was avoiding him. She'd recognized him, and her response to the horrible truth was to stick her head in the sand, an impulse Eli completely understood. Still, he kept trying. He called early in the morning. He called late at night. Rosa never picked up. Days, miserable, frantic, clench-fisted days, sped by, tipping into weeks, with the two voices constantly arguing in his head. "He's my son. No, he isn't. I'm Gabe's father. No, I'm not. It happened. No, it didn't." Some days he'd wake up calm, thinking, "What are the chances? What are the chances that some stranger I slept with half a dozen times 22 years ago, a stranger who told me she was going to have an abortion, didn't have an abortion, and had a son instead, and the son grew up and came to New York City and fell in love with my daughter. Are the chances one in a million? One in a billion?" Then he'd remember that people did win the lottery, even when their chances were infinitesimal. It happened sometimes. People got lucky. Or in his case, unlucky. Then it was June. Almost every morning, Eli would come up with a new idea, or revisit an old one. Steal a toothbrush. Ask to borrow a hairbrush. Tell Gabe breast cancer runs in the family and that we need to screen him for the BRCA gene. For a few hours, the idea would seem watertight and foolproof. Then doubt would creep in, and he'd find a dozen holes in the scheme he'd dreamed up and end up back where he'd started, completely and utterly fucked. There was only one more thing that he could think of, a Hail Mary pass. A high-risk, last-ditch maneuver. Only a desperate man would ever consider it. But Eli was desperate and completely out of options. And so he called his brother. "Sure," Ari said, without even asking what Eli wanted with him. Eli arrived at the diner where they'd agreed to meet, right on time, and secured a booth in the back. Ari sauntered in 10 minutes late, an ironic fedora cocked over his forehead. He looked handsome, happy, and relaxed. Eli hated him for it. As his brother slid into the booth, smiled at the waitress, and asked for a cup of coffee, light and sweet, Eli realized that this was a historic occasion, the first time in their lives that he had been the one to come to his brother for help. "What's up?" Ari asked. Eli swallowed hard. As succinctly as possible, he explained what he needed,
without exactly saying why. Gabe says he has no idea who his father is, and I just want to make sure that it's no one we need to worry about. Ari narrowed his eyes. Worry about how? He asked. Like, if his father's a mobster or something? He smirked. Could Gabe be the son of Sam?
I want to make sure there aren't any genetic issues, Eli said, and hoped his brother wouldn't push, which, of course, Ari did.
What, like cancer? Or what's that disease that Jewish people get?
Tay-Sachs, Eli said, tight-lipped.
He and Sarah had both been tested, he remembered, before Dexter had been conceived. But that's not what you're really worried about, is it? Ari's grin grew feral. What are you thinking? That this kid is, what, related to Ruby? Related to us? His smile got wider, turning even more greasy and sly. Related to you, my good brother? Eli forced his fingers not to drum and his knee not to bob up and down. He met Ari's gaze steadily. Annette and I had broken up, he lied, and I hadn't met Sarah yet. But yes, I think that I knew Gabe's mother.
Knew biblically, Ari amplified.
He had the nerve to look pleased with himself instead of being sympathetic. No condom? Eli kept his eyes on the table. It happened very fast, he muttered at the formica. I'm not surprised, Ari murmured. Eli ignored him. She told me she was getting an abortion, Eli said.
Yeah, they usually do, Ari said. You gave her money?
Eli nodded. Ari shook his head in fake commiseration. Okay, so she scammed you. But you were free and single. Just tell the kid you were going through a hoe phase. Ask him for a swab and you're done. Have you done this before? Ari smirked. No comment. Eli shook his head.
I can't. What if he tells Ruby or Sarah? Can you imagine how awkward that would be?
How's it going to be less awkward if I'm the one asking? Ari inquired. Eli didn't answer. He just waited for his brother to figure it out. Eventually, Ari did.
Oh, I get it. He's supposed to think that I'm the one who banged his mom.
He raised his eyebrows. Is she at least hot? Because I have my reputation to think of.
She's very pretty, Eli muttered. But he doesn't even need to think that either of us were involved with his mother. He doesn't have to know about this at all.
He reached into his pocket and showed his brother a copy of the key to Ruby and Gabe's apartment. Sarah, God bless her, had insisted that Ruby give them an extra key in case of emergency. Ari, still smirking, stirred his coffee slowly and said nothing. Eli looked into his brother's eyes. Ari, I've never asked you for anything, he said, and hoped Ari heard what he wasn't saying. And you've asked me for plenty. If you could do this one thing, I'd appreciate it. You can think of it as your wedding gift. A mean, petty part of him couldn't help but add. That way you won't have to buy them anything. He saw the hurt move across Ari's handsome face, quickly replaced by a mask of indifference. Eli felt the shameful stab of a memory. He and Ari as little boys, playing in the park on a cold, wintry afternoon, while their parents fought in the car. Let's pretend we're lost boys, Eli had said, urging Ari away from the sound of their father shouting and their mother crying because their dad had cheated on her again. Let's pretend we have to get away from Captain Hook. Once he'd been proud to be his brother's protector. When had it turned into this detestable chore?
Sure thing. You got it, Ari said, his face expressionless. One DNA test coming right up.
He held out his hand. Just give me the key. Eli handed over the key, plus the swabs and collection kit he'd ordered online and the envelope to mail it, and texted his brother the pertinent details.
Do you know when Gabe's out of the house? Ari asked.
Friday nights, Eli said. They'll be at our place for Shabbat dinner.
Guess I'm not invited, Ari said in a low voice before sliding out of the booth and off into the night.
Eli tried to be optimistic. Maybe this would work. Maybe the whole thing would go smoothly.
He shouldn't have been surprised when it didn't.
"Yeah, you're all set," Ari said, after 4 days had elapsed and Eli broke down and called him.
"Great, that's great. I'm really grateful."
"Three greats in one sentence," Ari observed. "I guess you are."
"Tell me where I can meet you and I'll pick it up."
There was a pause. Eli's heart sank.
"Well, I've been thinking," Ari said. "There's a few things I want to discuss."
Eli stifled a sigh. He'd been ready for this.
"How much?"
Ari's voice was affronted.
"What?"
"How much do you want?" Eli asked.
"I don't want your money," Ari snapped.
"Well, that's a change of pace," Eli thought.
"So what then?"
"Meet me tonight at 8 o'clock in Prospect Park by the boathouse." Eli agreed. That night, after dinner, he leashed Lord Farquaad, put on a WFMU t-shirt, shorts, and his miracle flip-flops, and made sure he had his checkbook in his pocket. Although Ari was probably using Venmo or Cash App or whatever the most up-to-the-moment grifters preferred. For once, Ari didn't keep him waiting. When Eli got to the appointed spot, his brother was sitting on a bench, his face tilted toward the setting sun. That night, the ironic hat was a pork pie, and he wore a dark blue shirt and what Eli assumed were fashionable sneakers. A few of the women and some of the men walking by gave his handsome brother approving glances. Don't be fooled, he thought about telling them. He's basically the essence of uselessness in the shape of a man.
"Hi, Ari," he said.
His brother nodded at him.
"Hey, dog," he said, and bent to greet Lord Farquaad, who growled and crowded behind Eli's knees.
Eli took a seat.
"So what's up?"
"I did what you wanted. I went to Ruby and Gabe's place, and I got a toothbrush, and I mailed it in. Here are the results."
From his pocket, Ari removed a Ziploc bag. Eli could make out a folded sheet of paper and the outline of a toothbrush inside of it. With a superhuman effort, he kept himself from reaching out and snatching it out of his brother's hand.
"So, can I have them?" Eli finally asked.
"I asked Ruby when Gabe's birthday is," Ari said.
Eli stared.
"What's that got to do with anything?"
"I told her," Ari continued, "that one of my old girlfriends does astrology, and she'd do their charts as a wedding gift." He paused.
"And then I did a little math."
He sat back, smirking at Eli.
"He's, what, 4.5 months younger than Ruby?"
"I'm surprised you remember Ruby's birthday," Eli said coldly. If Ari heard the implied criticism, he chose to ignore it.
"I looked it up, and I realized that you and Annette were still together when Gabe was conceived."
"Still married," he amplified, as if Eli might have forgotten, and pointed at his brother.
"That's the part you don't want Ruby knowing about."
Eli didn't speak, couldn't speak. He could do nothing but sit still on the splintery park bench and absorb the consequences of his own idiocy. Why had he thought he could go to his brother for help? Ari Danhauser had never done anything altruistic in his life. He always only ever looked out for himself.
"What do you want?" Eli finally asked.
There was what felt like another endless pause.
"Do you know I've been in therapy?" Ari finally asked.
"Recently?" Eli knew his parents had started sending their bright, troubled younger boy to therapists right around the time he'd refused to be bar mitzvahed. But as far as Eli knew, Ari had never taken therapy seriously, or gone of his own free will.
"Yeah," Ari said, and rubbed his hands along his shorts.
I met someone, and I decided it was time."
"Good for you," Eli said, and tried to find the generosity to mean it. If Ari could actually finally grow up, if he could find a job and stop hitting Eli up for money, it would be a good thing, a great thing.
"Are you familiar," his brother inquired, "with the term identified patient?" Eli indicated that he was not.
he refrained from telling his brother that he didn't want to learn new therapeutic terminology. He just wanted the results of the DNA test. Ari cleared his throat and adjusted the angle of his hat with one graceful, long-fingered hand. An identified patient, he began in a lecturing tone, is a dysfunctional family scapegoat. The other family members project their issues onto that person, and he or she gets blamed for everything, which means that the other members of the family never have to face their own issues or deal with their own shit. And, he concluded, the identified patient is never allowed to get better. Because if that person did get mentally healthy and stopped being the scapegoat, it would expose the real problems. The stuff the rest of the family doesn't want to talk about, or face up to, or fix. Eli pinched the bridge of his nose and tried to make himself count to 10 in his head before responding. He only made it to 6. Ari, I don't know how to break this to you, and I can tell it's going to come as a tremendous shock. But nobody is inventing your problems. They're real. Oh, right, Ari said sarcastically. Of course, you're the golden boy and I'm the fuck-up. You're Mr. Perfect and I'm Calamity Jane. You're the one who gets straight A's and I'm the one who sells Dad's coin collection to pay off his gambling debts. That actually happened, Eli shouted. Yeah, and do you know why? Ari asked. Because you and Mom and Dad all treated me like screwing up was all I could ever do. The hair on the back of Eli's neck started to prickle. Why are you telling me this now? He asked. For a moment, Ari didn't answer. I'll give you the results. But I want you to tell Mom and Dad, he said. What? Eli blurted. Ari had an unpleasantly smug look on his face. I want you to tell them that you cheated on Annette while she was pregnant, and that you knocked up some other lady. I want them to know that you're not as perfect as they think you are. And, he concluded, eyes gleaming with malice, I want you to do it at the wedding. Promise me you'll do that, and you get this. He waved the Ziploc tauntingly in front of Eli. And what if I don't? Eli managed to ask. Ari shrugged. Then I take this home, and I flush the results down the toilet, and you figure it out yourself. Eli tried to count to 10 again, and kept himself from shouting all of the things he wanted to say. Things like, fuck you, and that's never going to happen, and I die first. In his mind, he grabbed Ari, roaring, and lifted his brother over his head and threw him into the pond. In reality, he sat very still, afraid to move. Afraid to speak. Pick your poison, Ari said softly. Eli clenched his fists. You're going to therapy, right? He asked. Before Ari could nod, Eli asked, What does your therapist think of this scheme? Is she on board? Ari looked startled and hurt. Then he smirked. Do you see what you're doing here? You're making me the problem. Again. You are the problem. You're blackmailing me on the eve of my daughter's wedding. Startled, Ari said, It's tomorrow? I meant that figuratively, Eli said, raking his hands through his hair. Look, I'm not dismissing this whole identified patient thing. Maybe you're right. Eli did not, of course, think that Ari was right, but he could see his brother nodding and could tell that Ari's posture had relaxed. You want things to be different, right? Eli asked. You want Mom and Dad to see us both good and both bad instead of me as all good and you as all bad. Ari was nodding more vigorously. That's it. That's it exactly. I want a reset. His eyes shone. I think this family needs it. Okay then, fine. I promise. I'll tell them. I'll tell them at the wedding. I'll stand up in front of everyone. Only instead of making a speech congratulating the happy couple and welcoming Gabe to the family, I'll say that I slept with his mother. Is that what you want? Ari nodded. Yes, he said. That's what I want. Fine. Eli snarled. He held out his hand. Ari shook it. Then he handed over the bag. Eli tore it open, unfolded the page, and sat there motionless, paralyzed, feeling his world crashing down around him. DNA paternity report. Informational use only, read the heading. There were rows of numbers, lists of alleles collected, and at the bottom, the result. 99.9999% positive for paternity. Ari, reading over his shoulder, said, "Oh my, oh my." Eli slumped against the bench. His jaw sagged, his hands fell open. The Ziploc bag dropped to the ground, disgorging the remainder of its contents, a small plastic-wrapped blue toothbrush topped with the likeness of Grover from Sesame Street. Eli stared down at the toothbrush. "Ari," he said, after what felt like forever, "is that the toothbrush you took?" Ari looked down. "Yep." "That's not Gabe's toothbrush. That's Dexter's." Ari stared at him. "What was Dexter's toothbrush doing at Gabe and Ruby's place?" "He and Miles had a sleepover last weekend." Eli shut his eyes. "Well, how was I supposed to know this wasn't Gabe's toothbrush?" Ari demanded. "I don't know," Eli shouted back. "Maybe because there's a Sesame Street character on top of it?" Ari shrugged. "Oops." Eli got to his feet and started toward home with the dog plodding behind him. After a moment, Ari scrambled after him. "Hey, man, I'm sorry. Really, honest mistake. Want me to try again?" Eli shook his head. "There's no time." In a few days, they'd all be leaving for the Cape. His only hope, the only thing left to do, was to get Gabe's mother alone and make her tell him the truth. And hope against hope that the boy she'd given birth to, 8 months after they'd been together, had been fathered by someone who was not him. Ari was following him, still talking, but Eli wasn't listening. Before the wedding, he told himself, "I've got to find out for sure before the wedding, because if it is what I think and the worst is true, I cannot let my daughter marry this boy. I'll have to figure it out somehow. I'll have to find some way to stop it." Rosa.
"Mommy, are you okay?" Gabe had asked.
She fixed a smile on her face and hoped he'd be able to hear it.
"I'm fine. I'm so excited for you."
Gabe had wanted to FaceTime, but she'd bargained him down to a phone call. "I'm getting my hair done next week before I fly out, and I don't want you seeing your old mother like this," she'd said. Gabe had assented, but had heard something in her voice that had concerned him, and his kind, probing questions, "Is everything all right? Is there anything I can do?" made her want to scream and cry and rake her own face with her fingernails. "I don't deserve him," Rosa thought. "I'm fine," she'd assured him, and he'd promised her again that she had nothing to worry about. "Ruby's father and stepmom are good people. They'll like you. It's going to be fine."
"Sure," said Rosa, knowing that Ruby's father, whether a good person or not, was not going to like her, that it was not going to be fine.
She thought back to the beginning of the pandemic, when Gabe had told her he was moving in with Ruby, that Ruby's mom had found him a job, remembering how grateful she'd been that her son was safe. She'd called Ruby's mother to thank her, to offer to contribute to the expense of feeding and housing him. Sarah Danhauser had waved away her offer, saying, "Please, we should be paying you. Gabe's a delight. He cooks, he cleans, he's friendly first thing in the morning, and Ruby's brothers adore him. We're lucky to have him here. He's a wonderful kid. You should be proud." Rosa had been so glad that her son had found a safe harbor, that he'd found not just a girlfriend but a family, with other boys, and the kind of father who could show him, however belatedly, what a father should be. It was ironic, because soon she'd be face to face with that father, that good man. And he would know that Gabe had been raised by the kind of woman who'd mislead a man about being pregnant just to get a few $100. "We're lucky to have him here," Sarah had said. "You should be proud." Proud, Rosa thought, as a sob caught in her throat. Oh, if only she could be proud,
If only she'd behaved honorably. If only she'd told the truth. If only she'd done the right thing when there was still time. She tried to smile, to sound normal, as Gabe went over the travel plans. Rosa and Amanda had tickets from Los Angeles to Boston. Gabe would meet them at the airport in a rental car, and the three of them would drive up to the Cape together. "The house is incredible. I can't wait for you to see," Gabe told them, and explained that they'd all be in a guest house, with Gabe and Ruby in the master bedroom, and Rosa and Amanda in the living room. "We tried to find a hotel, but there wasn't anything within an hour's drive that weekend," Gabe said. "I'm sorry." Rosa couldn't breathe. She felt like a giant's hand was gripping her chest. Her knees felt trembly. Her belly was a knotted ache. "Don't apologize," she told her son. "I'm just happy I'll be with you. That's all I want." Meanwhile, Eli Danhauser was frantic to reach her. Every time she turned her phone on, she found another spate of texts and emails from him. "Please call. It's important. We need to talk." The last time it had happened, she'd gotten so dizzy, so sick with disgust and regret that she'd turned the phone off and thrown it onto her bed, like it was a snake that had bitten her. Then she'd deleted her email and text apps from her phone. It didn't mean his messages weren't still coming, but at least she wouldn't have to see them and have her mistake thrown in her face. Gabe talked, and Rosa let herself imagine how it would go. The plane ride. She pictured Amanda throwing back those miniature bottles of vodka and flirting with whatever men were nearby. The airport in Boston, where she'd never been. Seeing Gabe for the first time since the pandemic. She'd run to him and hug him so hard she'd probably leave bruises. She would bury her face in the space between his ear and his shoulder, letting the smell of his skin surround her. The last time she'd seen him, he'd had a new short haircut, and his clothes had smelled of a different detergent from the one she used. But beneath it all, he was still Gabe, her beloved angel boy. She would hold him, and he'd smile down at her. "Let me have this," she would think. "I won't have it for very much longer." Sarah. On Thursday afternoon, Sarah played hooky, slipping out of work early to meet Owen in front of the Guggenheim. They spent 2 hours in the museum, looking at the Picasso prints and the Frankenthaler watercolors, at Owen's favorite Matisse sculpture and Sarah's favorite Degas paintings. Then they'd gone to a cafe, where they'd lingered over drinks, asking each other polite questions, learning the contours of how the other had spent the last 20-plus years. Owen had talked about the Guggenheim collection in Venice, where it turned out he'd spent a semester abroad. "There's this one sculpture of a man on horseback with, an erection. Only the Pope was a great friend of Peggy Guggenheim's, so the sculptor made the penis detachable." "Handy," said Sarah. "Yes," Owen had deadpanned. "But is it art?" Sarah had listened and stolen looks at him, appreciating the way his blue button-down stretched against his shoulders, the economy and grace of his movements. He'd always been comfortable in his body, at ease in his skin. Eli, she knew, had shot up 6 inches between junior high and high school. He walked with a permanent stoop, the result of the years he'd spent bumping his head on door frames and ceilings that weren't sized for a man of his height. Eli was still sometimes oblivious to the way his body occupied space. Owen always seemed to know exactly where he was. "I'm glad I ran into you, because there are things I want to tell you," he said. "Things I should have told you a long time ago." "Are these things I'm going to want to hear?" Sarah asked, feeling her heart start beating hard. "I think so," Owen said. "I hope so, anyhow." He ran his hands over his close-cropped hair. "I wasn't honest with you back then, and you deserved to know what was really going on." She held herself very still, hoping none of what she was feeling showed on her face,
Okay, she said. I'm listening.
Owen rolled his shoulders and began to shred his paper napkin.
You remember what the camp was like, right?
Sarah nodded. She had lots of memories of the camp. The peeling paint, the single toilet, and its cinder block enclosure. The way Owen's tiny cabin had smelled of mouse and was so small that when you were lying in bed, you could touch both walls with your outstretched arms. She remembered the boathouse, full of abandoned and broken things, with its roof caving in. Back then, she'd been charmed by some of the camp's idiosyncrasies and oblivious to the rest. She hadn't cared where she was as long as she got to be with Owen.
I know your mom thought that it was a performance, right? Owen asked. Rich wasps pretending they were poor just for the hell of it. His voice had a hard, ironic edge.
Surprised, Sarah asked, Did she say that to you?
He raised his eyebrows.
You told me she called us the pond people, remember?
Sarah cringed. And I might have done a little eavesdropping the first night I came over for dinner.
Exotic, Sarah murmured, hoping she and her mother hadn't hurt teenage Owen's feelings.
My mom said you guys thought it was exotic and amusing to live that way.
Owen made a scoffing noise.
Maybe it was fun for some people. Maybe some of them were just pretending to be broke. But we weren't. We were the actual item.
Sarah sat very straight, waiting. Owen went on. Our house, our real house in Connecticut, was just like the camp. It was enormous and drafty and nothing worked right. It was falling down around our heads. He gave her a tight-lipped smile. But it didn't matter because it was big and in the right zip code and it looked fine from the outside if you didn't look too closely.
She stared at him. Wait, hang on, I know what you thought.
Owen sounded unhappy. You thought Sass was an heiress and that Eliza and I were rich and that Anders was...
Owen tilted his head back, staring at the ceiling, like he was reading a quote written there.
The wealthy scion of a prominent banking family, right?
Sarah nodded.
Not only had that been what she'd thought, but it had also been what the New York Times had said in Sass and Anders' wedding announcement, which she'd seen in a photo album on the sagging shelves in the camp's living room that held more board games than books. But that hadn't been the only thing convincing her that Owen came from old money.
You went to private school, you and your sister.
He nodded.
My great-grandparents set up a trust to pay for that. We got financial aid, too. Sass couldn't touch that trust.
His eyes were fixed on the table and the napkin.
Believe me, she tried.
And as for Anders, he might have come from a prominent banking family, but when my mother married him, he was unemployed, and he wasn't speaking to his father. My mom thought she'd married into wealth, and when she found out she hadn't, that Anders' grandfather had money, and his father had money, and his brothers had money, but what Anders had was some kind of bullshit degree as a life coach and no clients, she was furious. She started cheating on him on their honeymoon.
No, Sarah breathed.
Yes, said Owen. With the golf pro at the resort in Bermuda, I think. At least, that's what Anders would say when they were fighting.
He folded his hands.
Sass hoped that Anders would get it together or that his father would forgive him and let him join the family business, and she didn't want anyone knowing what was going on.
Oh, God. Sarah was thinking back, her mind shuffling through the minutiae of Owen's life that she'd collected over that summer, rearranging that evidence to tell a different story. She remembered how all of Owen's clothes were frayed or faded, how his swim trunks hung low on his hips because they were missing their drawstring, not that she'd minded back then, and how one of his sneakers had a hole in its sole. He'd always seemed to have enough money in his pocket for the minimal expenses of their dates. But back then, their most expensive night out entailed the purchase of 2 tickets to the drive-in and 2 lobster rolls. At first, Owen had insisted on treating, but Sarah had worn him down. telling him that she was a feminist, insisting that she wanted to pay her own way. She remembered feeling charmed by his nonchalance, finding his family's indifference to the material world endearing. At 18, it had compared favorably to the way her own family lived. The single thin frayed towel that Owen brought to the pond versus the stacks of plush, fabric softener-scented beach towels that her mom kept piled on the pool deck for family and guests. The nicked and weathered butcher block counters of the camp's kitchen versus the brand new granite countertops and state-of-the-art appliances in their house. The Lassiters had an ancient toaster with a fraying electrical cord, a wedding gift to Sass's own mother that sometimes shot sparks when you plugged it in. The Levy Weinbergs had a fancy